negotiates with the government. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Singer-songwriter Neil Sedaka has died. His family says he died yesterday at the age of 86. He wrote and performed many of the hits of the 1960s and 70s, beginning with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. His songs were also covered by Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, and the Captain and Tennille. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
Well, we might change the name of the show, but the music stays the same. Welcome to The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Dr. Lendell Calder from Augustana College. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. Well, I think it is fitting to have a historian here as we write a little bit of a new chapter in Quad Cities broadcast history. The longest running, continuously running program continues to run. That's Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded on WVIK. But something new is happening. We're going to be rebroadcasting these conversations on Monday evening. So Jarrett Johnson, our general manager, thought, let's just call it The Conversation. And I'm grateful that the very first conversation episode includes a good friend of mine, Dr. Lendell Calder, who is professor of history at Augustana College. Lendell, thank you for coming in.
Kai, it's great to be with you.
And history happens all the time. It happens to be happening rather quickly over the last 12, 24 hours. We are in hostilities again in Iran, and we don't know enough about this to call it history yet. It's still news. We'll let the journalists write the first draft. But anyway, I'm sure this is something you'll be thinking about in retrospect for a long time.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, let's get to all that stuff later. I'm just captivated by your career because I learned a little bit more about you through a lecture you gave, and we'll get to that later too, but about growing up in Texas and then making your way here to the banks of the Mississippi, but there's a lot of miles in between. Growing up in Texas, when and how did your interest in history begin to be kindled?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kai. You know, I can remember several moments. I gave a speech at a Cub Scout parent banquet once about the history of the Boy Scouts. What, I must have been 10 years old when I gave that speech. And I remember researching Lord Baden-Powell and the history of the Scouts and enjoying the experience. So, you know, it started pretty early. And then later, I had a memorable moment when my dad took me to a movie.
Yeah.
I was 12 years old. He took me to see Patton, starring George C. Scott.
Oh, wow.
And there's a moment in that movie, pretty early, where General Patton is being driven to the front lines of the Army Five Corps in Tunisia, I think. And he's being driven to the front lines with General Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to a fork in the road out there in the desert. And the driver turns right. And Patton raps him on the head with his riding crop and says, "Go left." And General Bradley says, "But the front line is to the right, General." And Patton says, "Go left." So they go into the middle of nowhere until they come to these ruins. And Patton hops out of the Jeep and he kneels down on one knee and he says, "It happened here.
Yeah.
2,000 years ago." And he described a battle where the Carthaginians had been assaulted by Roman legions and totally wiped out. And he said, "I was there." And Bradley and the other aides look at Patton like he's nuts or something. Mm. But I'm looking at Patton there as a 12-year-old kid in the theater thinking, it's like he's got x-ray glasses. He can see things nobody else can see.
Exactly.
And yeah, I thought, Wouldn't that be a cool superpower to have? And essentially, that's what historians cultivate, is
right.
those X-ray right. glasses.
I think that's hilarious you mentioned that, because the movie was very impactful for me, too,
really?
In my youth. And yeah. it was just on one of these, like, American movie classics or yeah. something like that. It was just on. And I thanked my very patient spouse. Normally, when we have a few minutes in the evening, we watch the previous night's talk shows, right,
yeah.
and get a sense there. But we were watching. I said, oh, my gosh, there's Patton. And she endured it for a few minutes. But it was great a great memory of my childhood, watching that movie. And what a flawed person that was. But it was true. That's a scene that's burned in my memory. And he says, no, I was there. I was there.
Yeah.
And that's the thing we get to do when we read history and immerse ourselves in history. And I'm very grateful for that. But at what point was high school, college, somewhere along the line that you started to think that this is more than just an interest, this is a possible livelihood?
No, it came way later.
Okay.
I didn't even take much history in school. I think I went to summer school for U.S. history mm-hmm. so that I didn't have to take it during the year. And then I tested out of history classes in college, so I didn't really take a lot of basic history there. And I was a psychology major in college.
That's right. You told me that.
Yeah. I didn't know what I wanted to be. People said, you should be this, you should be that. And I just didn't know and didn't have an inner drive for anything, really. So after college, I took a job with an interdenominational Christian ministry called the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
That kept me in the university environment, kept me reading and thinking, and gave me 5 years to figure it out. And I had a three-year evaluation in that period, and 20 people were interviewed about me and the job I was doing. And one of the questions was, where do you see Lendl in 10 years? Where would you like to see him? Every single person, 20 out of 20, said, he should be a college professor.
Hey.
I'd never thought of that.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. yeah.
But when that many people tell you, you should do this, you should take that seriously. And I did. I knew I didn't want to be a professor of psychology. So I thought, what classes interested me the most in college? And it was my European history classes.
Hmm.
I went to grad school, and first thing I learned was, if you're going to study European history, you need to speak a few European languages, and I didn't. So I fell into American history by default, really. I'd always thought American history was boring, red coats and all that. And I pretty quickly discovered that I was misinformed on
yeah.
that account.
Well, when I was an undergrad, I took every history class I could at Augie that dealt with Russian and East Asian history.
I loved history. Russian history. I did. Oh,
well,
yeah.
and just because in the 80s, that was our adversary.
Yeah,
it's still our nemesis, but and that's what kids wanted to take, right? And
yeah.
I don't even think we taught Chinese at the time at Augustana, but now, of course, we do. And
I took Russian history from a professor who was there in 1917.
You're kidding.
No, Oliver Radke.
Wow.
The course I took with him was his final course. He retired at the end of that term. I remember the big celebration on the last day of class. But it was riveting to hear him talk about the revolution as an eyewitness.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong, was that at Texas?
Yeah, University of Texas.
I got to say, that's a beautiful campus. I got to stroll around once in Austin.
We call it the 40 acres.
Well, and it was, you can see, oil money builds some really pretty buildings.
Yeah, that Spanish
style. Yeah, yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah. It was a lovely, lovely campus.
Yeah.
Anyway, and for me, it wasn't until after I took an obligatory American history class from a professor we had here named Ross Paulson, who was absolutely fussy about getting your facts right.
My predecessor.
Right.
And a great historian.
Oh, wonderful. And I love his memory. But he... I thought, well, okay, this is kind of interesting. But right after I graduated, somebody thrust in my hands the book The Killer Angels by Michael Shara.
Uh-huh.
And I just devoured it. And then I started reading Shelby Foote, who is a very entertaining historian.
Yes.
And that's where the American history got sparked. But I'm glad you got into American history, because it was your, our acquaintance was over, I think, the publication of your, was it your doctoral thesis, Financing the American Dream?
Or? That was my dissertation. It became a book later.
And it became quite a stir. Mm-hmm. And it was picked up by the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kinds of national media. And I still remember.
One reviewer said, he writes really well for a college professor.
You got to keep that one framed on the wall. But it was captivating. I think it caught the attention of those journalists because you were making a case that hadn't been made before.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, when I first decided to study how Americans became accustomed to the idea of being in debt all the time, I thought I was going to go into the archives or into the data and see, you know, once upon a time, everybody lived within their means. And then the credit card was invented, and we've all been on a road to financial ruin ever since. That's what I thought the story was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have been more wrong. Turns out the Pilgrims came to the United States on an installment plan.
Yeah.
And Americans have been indebted for the things that they want ever since. And if that seems strange to you, I mean, think about it. This was a rural nation. Mm-hmm. 95% of people lived on farms. Mm-hmm. You don't buy farms with cash. You go into debt for that.
Right.
And so that's how America became the country that invented consumer credit. Is we've always been sort of accustomed to this idea of achieving the American dream through debt.
Yeah. Well, what I found very captivating about it is I was a young adult at the time. I think you and I are still kind of young adults, but but you know, and I was establishing credit too. But your subtext was that this was good for us to have the discipline that you had to keep getting a paycheck to pay off your Sears card.
Yeah, most people writing about consumer credit had taken the view that this is awful, a violation of morality and common sense. My view is more nuanced than that. Sure, some people get into debt too much, but it's not as many as you think historically.
Yeah.
Most people, when they take on debt, have to work hard to pay it back.
Right.
And so credit became a kind of disciplinary agent on American finances that way. Mm-hmm. Shifting spending away from consumables like food towards durables like automobiles. So that's the function consumer credit played in American culture.
Well, again, it played out in my life because at about 95, when I became a father, and there's a serious amount of debt that comes with being a parent.
Yeah.
That's when I had to make the decision to leave what I called the macaroni and cheese budget of working for WVIK and then go across the street to other things at Augustana College. But that was all part of it. That must have been kind of heady getting invited to all those interviews in those days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody wanted to talk to me after the book came out. And that was a fun ride for about 5 years.
But there were other things that came along that I don't think maybe made as big a splash in the Wall Street Journal. But you became you were recognized for your teaching, and then you were brought into a Carnegie-funded initiative to look at the effectiveness of teaching. And I always thought that was fascinating, not just that you went away to learn about this, but you came back and started to sort of leaven pedagogy here at Augustana.
Yeah, and that was a happy, not an accident, but it's not something I really intended for myself. In 1999, same year my book had been published, mm-hmm. The dean of the college here, Rick Jurasek, came to me and he said, I think you'd be good for this program that I've just heard about. It's being sponsored by the Carnegie Foundation for Higher Education. They want to change how we think about teaching in colleges and universities. And they're looking to establish a kind of advanced study institute where scholars will come and invent new pedagogies for their disciplines. He said, would you be interested in that? And I don't know why he came to me. I think it was because I had just gone through a review. And in that review, I had boasted that I had invented a new way of teaching American history that I thought was probably the best American history course in the entire country.
Hey.
You know, I was young and reckless.
That's all right.
Trying to impress people. So I made that grandiose statement. And I think he read that and then thought of me when he was reading this announcement. So he sponsored me more or less for this program. I got in. I was the youngest person in the cohort.
Wow.
They ran this program for 7 years. They created an Institute of Advanced Study that included about 70 scholars from all the disciplines. I always wondered, why did they choose me? There were presidents of the American Mathematical Association was one of the scholars and high-powered people, and I was just nobody.
Well, you were the only one that devised the best American history class ever.
Well, I later found out why they picked me.
Yeah.
Yeah, just by an accident, somebody asked me to go find something in my file, and I was looking through my file at the Carnegie headquarters, and there was my application with their notes in the margin. And the Lee Shulman, the president of the Carnegie Foundation, had written, well, he doesn't know much about teaching, but he really writes well. We can use that.
That's awesome that you found that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, somewhere along the line, if my memory serves, weren't you named Professor of the Year in Illinois?
Yeah, that came, 10 years later.
10 years later,
and that was
okay.
The beginning of some recognition for the work that I and others were doing to change how history is taught in college.
And can you summarize that? Because I love it when you talk about teaching, because I was a student in the older model, and now today's students benefit from a newer model.
Yeah, and I think our listeners who are over the age of 30 probably know what the older model was like. If you took a history course in college, or even high school courses can look like this. I was giving a workshop once about what I call my signature pedagogy for history. And a professor came up afterwards and he said, well, after listening to your talk, I realize I'm doing all the wrong things, but I insist that I'm doing it in the proper and customary way. So what was the proper and customary way? That a professor talks, students listen. You have midterm examination, a final examination, usually multiple choice. And if it's a liberal arts college, you have to write a paper. That was the traditional, customary way. And just on my own, teaching here at Augie and before I came here, I could see this way didn't work.
Yeah.
Most students just went into a dark secret place in their mind while I'm talking, and they're not listening at all, not learning anything. And That's why I was interested in this Carnegie program. I didn't know how to teach history, but I knew that what I was doing wasn't working.
Mm.
So I wanted to figure out a new way.
Well, and I want to come back to that at some. Well, maybe let's just do it. What I find fascinating is you've already described a couple of moments of intellectual humility, right? And when we have to say that, I'm not sure that this is absolutely right. I can question the Pharisees, I think that's key, not just to being a good teacher, but also to navigating citizenship. I mean, to have a little bit of that humility. And I don't know if that's something that you talk about directly with your students or.
Well, humility is one of the heuristics that I intentionally teach. The difference between the old way and the new way is the old way emphasized a professor talking about everything a person would need to know if they were going to become an expert in that discipline. And obviously what's wrong with that is most of the students in my classes aren't going to become historians. So why am I even trying to load their minds with all these names, dates, places, etc.? They're not going to become historians. They'll never think about any of this after this course. So, that's why the old way didn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And the new way emphasizes instead of covering lots of content, we still have plenty of content, but we don't try to cover every essential piece of information. Instead of that, we uncover how historians think, how they create the knowledge that we call history. It turns out that since we're all human beings, we're all historical. We're all trying to make sense of history, our own history, other histories. So this isn't just for historians. It's for everybody. And I teach in my introductory courses six basic historical thinking skills. I call them heuristics because mm-hmm. they're things experts know to do that beginners don't know to do. Mm. And one of those is intellectual humility, knowing what you don't know and recognizing there's always stuff you don't know and figuring out how to change that.
We all have narratives. You're talking about we all are historians in one sense. We have a history. We have a story about our lives. And one of the things that I found very captivating is in the low stakes realm of local politics, and I'll call it that. When you question someone else's narrative, you will rarely get a more vehement response. People will build narratives on things that are demonstrably untrue and easily proven to be counterfactual. Uh-huh. And yet to challenge that narrative evokes a response that is, whoa.
That's because the stories we tell about the world, about ourselves, about our families, about our countries, the stories tell us who we are and what we need to do next. That's what stories do for us. So when you challenge somebody's story, you're basically calling into question essential features of their identity.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to look up this quote. It's one of my favorites by Muriel Rukeyser.
Right.
Yeah. The world is made of stories, not of atoms.
Yeah. I think it was Dr. Youngberg who introduced me to that quotation many years ago when we team taught in the honors program. It's a lovely quotation. The world is made of stories, not of atoms. And of course, a poet would say that. But if you think about it, it's literally true. Because when I say atom, what's the image in your mind? You think of that elementary school science book, mm-hmm. picture of the atom with the nucleus mm-hmm. and the electrons. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That's not what atoms actually look like.
Yeah.
That's a story
we tell about
the atom. And that's how we make sense of the world, is through stories.
Well, you've been very good at conveying those stories. And one of the ways we know that demonstrably is that you were named one of three finalists for a very prestigious award, the Robert Foster Cherry Award for Great Teaching, which is run by the folks at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And I understand you didn't necessarily know you were being nominated for that.
Oh, I knew.
You did know.
True.
Okay.
I knew I was being
But I know
nominated.
Your colleagues helped a great deal.
Jane Simonson, one of my colleagues in history, led the effort, and she recruited, we must have had 15 letter writers, half of them my colleagues, half of them students, former students.
Yeah.
She did a magnificent job rounding up all those letter writers. And that's one of the great moments of my professional life, to read those letters.
Yeah.
What an honor. What a privilege.
Well, we're going to get to more about that in just a minute. But I want to remind you, friends, my guest this week is Dr. Lendell Calder from Augustana College's History Department. And here on The Conversation, we're going to take a break just a moment. It's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to The Conversation on WVIK. We want to remind you, friends, that if you are interested in doing a little traveling and story making yourself, you can go to WVIK.org right now and learn more about a cruise down the Danube to visit Christmas markets from Nuremberg down to Vienna. We'll be back in just a moment with The Conversation. This is Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM.
Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins Counseling in Bettendorf, offering the Shamanic Journey Group every third Sunday of the month to learn to connect with power animals and spiritual teachers. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
This week on No Small Endeavor, how far would you go to change the world?
You're going up this little tributary in the Amazon, and if something goes wrong, if the motor breaks, and there's no 911, there's no helicopter evac, it's just you.
Conservationist Paul Rosalie and I discuss the vital work of protecting the Amazon and why it matters to us all.
Sunday at 6 a.m. on WVIK.
And friends, if you get a chance to listen to No Small Endeavor on WVIK, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. 6 a.m. on WVIK and available as a podcast. Look up WVIK.org. Welcome back to the conversation on WVIK, a chat with this week's guest, Lendell Calder. And I was just kind of teeing up here a little bit this Robert Foster Cherry Award. And one of the reasons I was very grateful that your colleagues did indeed get you nominated is each one of the finalists was asked to present a lecture in their discipline or a presentation. And although it's a bit of an irony, you have said that you've kind of pioneered a way of teaching that doesn't rely as much on lectures. Here was this lecture, and I got a chance to hear it when you gave a sort of a first rendition here at Augustana, and it was captivating from start to finish. And I found most interesting your weaving in of your story with what I take to be part of your thesis, that from the perspective of a historian of the United States, that what this country could really benefit right now is a meta-narrative that we would focus on rather than these jots and tittles and facts that this community agrees on and the other community does not. So how did all that come together in writing that wonderful lecture?
Yeah, well, in the traditional and customary way of history teaching, at the introductory course level, the professor races through 400 years of history, or 1,000, whatever, and they spend, you know, the same 15 seconds on every single name, date, place, event as they race through the content. To students listening, that just becomes a blur of unrelated, random stuff. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense until you take all that and turn it into some kind of narrative or story. So in addition to, in my signature pedagogy for history, in addition to teaching them how historians think, I'm also emphasizing this concept of meta-narrative, the big stories we use to interpret the topics that we're studying. Mm-hmm. So when I teach students about American history since the Civil War, for example, mm-hmm. we don't cover every topic. For example, we don't even look at World War I. Big topic, but we don't look at it because I'm not interested in covering every single important topic. But they learn a big story about the United States from the Civil War to the present. They learn about four or five, six stories that explain American development. And I teach them how to tell the difference between a sensible story and a nonsensical story so that they can make up their own mind about what story they want to believe in that best explains American history. And American history has always featured arguments over the meaning of American history. That's part of who we are as a people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I feel like I'm on the front lines of citizenship training by taking this approach with history, because they're learning to agree or to disagree agreeably with people who tell different stories. They're learning how to tell the difference between a good story and a very poor story that couldn't possibly be true. Mm-hmm. And all of that's critical for this moment in American history where the notion of a truth itself is under attack from all directions. I feel like a frontline soldier in defense of the concept of truth, and that it's possible to know some things and that are true. Mm-hmm. Students today come to college finding that a hard thing to believe in. They just pretty much by default now believe, everything. I can't believe anything. It's all fake news. And that's death for a democratic republic like ours.
Right, right. I don't know that it's necessarily new. I remember sitting in a classroom with one of your predecessors, Van Simmons, and we were studying Chinese history. I mean, nobody taught it better than that guy, but there was a clear split in the class between the couple of people who said, if you look at the sweep of 20th century, because the 20th century wasn't done then, but 20th century history, the net was the communists probably were a better way for China to go than some of the alternatives they'd been heading down. Mm-hmm. But that was very counter. Mm-hmm. to the prevailing narrative for about 80% of the class. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of shock value there. And I remember religion classes. I mean, this school happens to be more on the liberal, non-Pharisaic side of theology. And there were truths that were being questioned that students would get up and leave class. I mean, I think that happens. But you're right now, what's happening is we're sort of, it's becoming more of a nationality test, right? Which story will adopt or eschew is going to define your citizenship or your nationhood.
Yeah, and it all of this stems from misunderstandings about what history actually is. People on both the left and the right often believe that history is what happened. The job of the historian or the history teacher is to tell you what happened. The truth. That's it. Rush Limbaugh used to say, that's all history is. It's what happened. Well, if that's true, then the traditional customary way for teaching history makes sense. Okay, yeah, let's just give exams over what happened. The problem with that is, let's put 10 historians or 10 people in a room and ask them, okay, what happened? I'm teaching a course in the 60s right now. What happened in America in the 1960s? Pretty quickly, you're going to find nobody agrees on what happened.
Right.
Even on what happened, we don't agree. So the central nature of history as knowledge is that it's an argument, not a fact. All right, so our historical interpretations should end in question marks, not in exclamation marks. Mm. That's what I would say.
Well, I love that. I've been watching, and I've not gotten to the end yet, but I've been watching The American Revolution, the latest Ken Burns.
Yeah.
I still got a couple of hours to go. I think I know how it's going to turn out. Not exactly. But in watching it, I'm struck by the phenomenon. I learned some things that are not very pleasant truths that I wasn't aware of about. I knew there was terrible internecine violence and all this kind of stuff. But I'm learning some things that are not terribly comfortable to learn. But it doesn't shake my meta-narrative that for all of its flaws, this is the best experiment in governance that the Earth has seen, America, right? And I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I don't know if it was Churchill who said, you know, democracy is awful, except that it's slightly better than everything else. But we've got governmental intrusion at the state level, more so, well, some at the national, yeah, but I mean, where states decide what can and can't be taught, as if we can't expose young citizens to the warts. And I don't know that that's in the end beneficial.
Yeah, high school history teachers have been dealing with this for a long time, but it's coming now to college teachers. Florida has just passed legislation mandating a certain sociology textbook for intro soc classes, and that textbook, you know, rejects what the MAGA people call gender ideology and inserts its own gender ideology called patriarchy. Anyway, the next thing they're going to do is history, American history, and Texas, I believe, is lining up to do the same thing. So, I never thought this would be happening in the United States, because this is the way the old Soviet Union under communism treated history.
Yeah. There was
and
the approved narrative.
And now we're doing it ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was the approved meta narrative. Mm-hmm. And then nothing else could work in that regard. Now, we're going to bow to some local history here in just a moment. But when we come back, you've also been doing some great research more recently about how students are consuming things, and I find that very, very fascinating. But did your tenure, I'm trying to remember when Roald Tweet retired. Was he still in the classroom when you started? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great. And he worked out something fantastic. I don't know if you remember this, but if I ever wrote a history of Augustana, I would include these as more than footnotes. But he worked out a way that for the last years of his career, he didn't serve on any committees. took no part in governance whatsoever, and just managed a way to teach a class when he wanted to and the class that he wanted to. So my wish for all of my beloved professor friends is that the last couple of years of your career can be that way. But fortunately, he continued to teach and continues to teach us through the auspices of Rock Island Lines, which we're grateful to present each and every week here on The Conversation on WVIK. And now, Rock Island Lines.
This is Rolled Tweet on Rock Island. 2 years ago, January, I stood along the Straits of Magellan with a group of Rock Island college students traveling in South America. For 2 days, I could not bring myself to walk down to the water's edge. I knew the real straits would not come up to my fourth-grade weekly reader imagination, where Magellan and his fleet of ships passed through perilous narrow cliffs on tempest-tossed seas to reach the west. And it was so. Here at the tip of South America, the summer sun still showed low above the horizon at 9 in the evening, and in that glimmering light, the straits lay calm. 3 miles across the water, layers of hills bordered the opposite shore like blue shades of torn construction paper. I thought of my own Rock Island water, the mighty Mississippi, the father of waters, the river of Huck Finn and Jim. Like the fabled Amazon and Nile, the Mississippi must be a letdown for those who come from their own weekly readers. Crossing the Interstate 80 bridge for the first time, visitors must certainly look down and think, "That's it?" Imagination seems to cheat. It's a bump to learn the moon is neither a goddess nor green cheese. We imagine rose-covered cottages and often find divorce. We should have stayed in fourth grade forever, or we should have skipped it entirely. Not really. If imagination sent you seeking out the Mississippi or the Straits of Magellan, real water will add flesh to those dreams. A real partner who snores is better than dreams or pillows that don't, usually. So come on down from that bridge. Build a house by the Mississippi. Drift its currents in a boat. Catch a few catfish. Smell the musky river water. Watch the ice break in the spring. Better yet, watch the flood water slowly rise, trickle up your yard into your basement, push against the foundation with a power you cannot imagine. As your house floats away, you will look deep down and say, "I do believe." Your weekly reader will have become a pleasant fairy tale, good for getting things going, but not for real waiting.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And you can support stories like that and history like that with, donation, membership to WVIK.org. We make it really easy to do. There's a nice bright red button that says donate. And my conversation with Lendell Calder continues on history writ large, but sticking with history locally, I want to tell you, friends, about something really fun that's coming up on March 27th. Many of you might know Dean and Deb Mathias, who are legends in local bicycling communities. The QCBC, Quad City Bicycle Club, probably wouldn't exist in its current format without them. Well, we're trying to raise a little money to have a nice memorial to, well, not memorial, they're still with us, a statue honoring Dean and Deb Mathias. And there's going to be a fun trivia night March 27th, and you can find out full details at QCBC.org and find a way to salute a wonderful piece of local history as we continue our conversation about history written a little bit larger with Dr. Lendell Calder from Augustana College's History Department. Your study of history and the teaching of history continues apace. And during your Robert Foster Cherry lecture, I heard you reference some work you're doing in trying to gauge how students are responding to history. Tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I've been running a research project for 30 years now.
Mm.
It's based on an assignment I give students the first week of the introductory U.S. history course. And the assignment asks them to imagine they're in a foreign country and they get in a conversation with a new friend, and that friend asks them to tell them the story of the United States, its history.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell them? So I have 30 years worth of mostly freshmen and sophomore students telling me their story of American history.
Yeah.
I have two stipulations in the assignment. It has to be one page or less, and they can't look anything up. They have to do it out of their head. And students, when I give this assignment the first day of class, they think I'm trying to find out what they don't know, right? And that's actually not the case. I want to know what narrative framework is in their head to make sense of the American past before they, take my course. So I've been doing this for 30 years, and I have seen a remarkable change in the stories that students tell about American history. And it's not a good change, I don't think.
Mm.
30 years ago, about 80% of the students told the same story.
Yeah.
And it's a story, Kai, that you grew up with, that I grew up with, anybody over the age of 50 grew up with. It's a story of American history as a quest for freedom. Freedom as an idea is brought to this country. The seed is planted. It grows over time. It's a story of progress. My students and I will call this story now the glory story. American history is a story of an exceptional rise to international leadership in the story of democratic freedom. So 80% 30 years ago told that story. Last fall, when I gave the assignment, not a single student told that story.
Really?
Not a single one. And that's been common for 3 or 4 years now.
Mm.
There are, I would say, 5 or 6 big narratives that people have told to make sense of the American past. Mm-hmm. The glory story is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other stories. There's a gory story where people say, yeah, the United States is born in slavery, born in the dispossession of the land from its original inhabitants. The American history is the story of the denial of freedom, liberty, and justice. And most everything in the world that's bad can be traced back to the imperial United States. That would be a gory story of the United States, and a lot of people believe that story. There's the story that we can, based on our national motto, out of many one, where the American history is the story of immigrants and how they created the world's first multicultural democracy.
Mm-hmm.
High ideals, mixed results is a story many people tell, particularly, say, center-left Democrats. This is a country that began with good intentions but has struggled mightily to live up to them. As John Kennedy said, we're a good country, we could be a better country. So I call that story high ideals, mixed results. What's interesting, Kai, is that over the last 30 years, as the glory story has faded away and become extinct, what's interesting is what's replaced it. Now, if you listen to Fox News very much, you know what they think replaced it. They think what has replaced it is some kind of Marxist-inspired story of the people versus the elites. But no, almost no students tell that story. Instead, what's replaced it is no story.
Mm.
Students just say, yeah, well, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, and then something else happened, and then another thing happened, and then another thing happened, and then this happened, and then out of nowhere, Vietnam happened, and then Woodstock happened, and then Iraq happened, and here we are today.
Mm.
It's just a recital of random events that have no connection to each other and no overall meaning. Kind of like that old Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire,
right.
Where he just, every stanza is this random collection of things that happen. That's what about 90% of my students today, that's what their stories look like.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one thing after another, no meaning at all.
Yeah.
Now, that's worrisome to me, Kai, because why would you study or think history is important if it doesn't have any meaning?
Yeah.
I have sort of in the last 10, 15 years begin tilting my course to deal with this new kind of phenomenon that students are unstoried, to emphasize now the importance of figuring out what the story is. Because if you don't have a story, then you don't have a democratic citizenship, because we don't have anything that binds us. Here in the United States, blood doesn't bind us. We come from everywhere. Language doesn't bind us because we speak many languages. We have many religions. What's going to bind us? The only thing that can bind us, so that somebody in Florida cares what somebody in Washington State has for their medical coverage, the only thing that could make us care like that across regions, races, religions, would be some kind of national story that we all believe in. And I frame my course now, my signature Pedagogy for History, as an attempt to answer the question, what's the story of American history? And I'm not trying to force my students into my own story, what I think the story is, because the reality is America, at the core of American history, has been an argument over what the story of our country is.
Exactly.
And I'm now just kind of bringing students into that conversation about what the story is and equipping them to live in a society where we're not going to agree on the answer.
I will say one thing, and I try not to be a pincushion, you know, constantly offended and affronted by things that are going on in the news. But one thing that really struck home is they're flashing some sort of a projection on the Washington Monument in honor of America's 250th, which is something seriously to be thought about. And one of the documents or one of the statements says, America is not an idea.
That's going to be on the monument?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're trying to support a narrative that says it's heroic white men who sacrificed over time and it did so in the name of a Christian God and yada, yada, yada. But that really offended me because I ascribe to your point of view. I think what's going to save the Republic is if we come back to the notion that we are an idea. And if we are a competitive people, so let's feed that competitive idea by saying it's the best idea that's happened. And nobody's come up with a better idea. But if we abandon the idea, well, woe be unto us and that republic. So
I agree with that, Kai. I agree with Lincoln that America is the last best hope, meaning something strange happened around 1776, and some ideas were birthed that had not been part of anybody's theory of government before. And this country ever since has been in a struggle over what to do about those truths, that all men are created equal, for example. How do we live out those truths? And you say you're offended by this notion put forward by J.D. Vance now and others that America is not an idea. I disagree with that. I'm not offended by it in the sense, as a historian, I know we've been arguing about this for a long time.
Sure.
And
I think you can argue about the idea
vehemently. And I also, I would go so far as to say that idea is a distant echo of that old lost cause narrative that emerged after the Civil War to rehabilitate Southern white elites who believed that America was not an idea, but a culture that based on white supremacy.
Right.
And here's that idea being projected on the National Monument. It's okay to be, we should be offended by that. I'm changing my mind. That's offensive. My offense is tempered by my knowledge that, J.D. Vance didn't invent this argument. It's been going on a long time.
Well, and you know, tying it to the lost cause, I hadn't thought of it that way, but thank you. So I'm learning stuff too. And we're going to run out of time here. But before we do, I want to try to end on a brighter, more uplifting, positive note and ask you a question I love to ask interesting guests. What are you reading lately? What are you watching, listening to? That kind of stuff. And hopefully it's uplifting.
What have I been reading lately?
Yeah.
I've been struggling. I have developed a problem with my eyes that I'm going to have surgery for in a month. But okay. Reading has been hard lately. But yeah. I've been struggling to read Wuthering Heights.
Oh, really? Good for you.
Because, you know, the movie came out. I was reading reviews of the movie. And it reminded me that I was much affected by Wuthering Heights as a 13-year-old kid.
Really? Good for you.
I thought, I wonder what it was about that book that so captivated my imagination. So I'm rereading it to find out why.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because what I have found, we've got a little fiction book club at Augie, and we've been reading some pretty heavy stuff in that. So I finished the last book early, and so just to get a little bubblegum, I'm reading Lieutenant Hornblower by C.S. Forrester.
Yeah, I love that book.
Oh,
as a
kid. But I mean, you know, he first wrote a book about Hornblower as a captain, and then he later, I don't know, you know, decided to do a prequel. They didn't call him that at
the
time.
Oh, yeah, I love that series.
And it's just fun. It's light. It's engaging. And I'm the same way. Why did this speak to me in my 20s? When I read it. And it still does. I haven't answered the question, but I'm trying. I'm figuring it out. Well, I wish you well with that medical future of yours. I'm sure everything will be just fine. But in the meanwhile, anything else that you're reading or watching or anything?
Reading is hard. I've been watching a lot of television at night. So Ann and I are watching a show called Tehran, actually.
Oh,
so
really? That sounds interesting.
Very timely. Yeah, it's... 3 seasons so far. It's about activities of Mossad inside the Iranian Republic, and it humanizes both sides, the Iranians and the Israelis, and it's just a total nail biter. In fact, Anne has recently decreed we cannot watch it after 9 p.m. We need an
She's
hour.
She's a smart woman. I've always known that. Well, yeah, so we try to end our evenings with something comical. But when it's the local, or not the local, when it's the latest shows like Kimmel and Colbert and that kind of stuff, it can be funny, but it can also be quite disquieting. So I just want to, I'm curious.
You're such a boomer.
When is the,
ending the evening, it's like watching Johnny Carson.
Of course, I'm a boomer. I'm the last class of boomers, I think. But when is this set? Because I think the Mossad has been in Iran for a long time. But when is this series set?
It's contemporary.
It's contemporary, yeah. Because there's stuff that Israel finds out about Iran that it could only find out if it was actually in there.
But it's fascinating inside look at Iranian society and all the divisions between Iranians and...
Well, and I would
highly recommend it.
Have you ever seen the film Persepolis? It's
yes.
an animated film. So I was going to say, for folks who would like, that's also a very compelling thing that talks about the dangers of a religious autocracy. Mm-hmm. And I think it would set up. But Tehran, okay, we're going to check that out and see where it leads us. But for now, I hope it went as fast for you, Lendl, as it did for me, because this just seemed to fly by for me. And
it's always great to talk with you, Kai.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And that's going to have to do it for this week. And I want to thank my guest, Dr. Lendl Calder from the Augustana College History Department. Remember, friends, you can catch The Conversation twice each week on WVIK, Saturday morning live at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You'll also find recent episodes at wvik.org. Look for us under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on WVIK, when our guest will be retired Senior Foreign Service Officer Melinda Pavek. Her career with the State Department took her to Iraq and places that were rather hairy at the time she was there. We'll look forward to hearing all about it right here on The Conversation on WVIK. Stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll get some news from NPR. And then, of course, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or whatever happens at 9 o'clock. I got to get used to this new format, Lendl, but I think we did okay for today. Friends, thanks for tuning in. This is your public radio station, WVIK.
Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins Counseling in Bettendorf, offering the Shamanic Journey Group every third Sunday of the month to learn to connect with power animals and spiritual teachers. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com. Support for WVIK comes from Nahant Marsh, which presents the Oberholzer Awards, recognizing past, present, and future champions of conservation in the Quad Cities. The 2026 awards event is March 7th at the Bend Event Center, with tickets and nomination information at nahantmarsh.org.
Seconds before 11 o'clock here on your public radio station, and we'll tell you that Quad Cities NPR is WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island. Stay tuned. More is next on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.